We heard Stormy Weather from the Charles Mingus Jazz Workshop album. Ted Kirson was the trumpeter, Eric Dolphy on reeds, Charles Mingus, of course, on bass, and Danny Richmond drums. Ted Kirson is with me in the studio now. He's in Philadelphia for a concert this coming Friday and Saturday evening in memorial to Eric Dolphy. There'll be two shows, by the way, at 9 and 11. A little bit about Ted Kirson. He grew up here in Philadelphia and was later encouraged by Miles Davis to go to New York, where he ended up playing with Philly Joe Jones, Mal Waldron, and Cecil Taylor. In 1960, he joined Charles Mingus Jazz Workshop, where he played with Eric Dolphy for, I believe it was 2 years.
Yeah.
He stayed
mm-hmm.
with the workshop. And after those 2 years, he started his own group. And in 1964, a recording with this group was released called The New Thing and The Blue Thing, and also they recorded a session which has recently been released by Arista Records, and that one's called Tears for Dolphy. Ted Kirson has also spent a lot of time in Europe playing there as well as in the States. Let's start with talking about the Mingus Jazz Workshop. How did you get involved with the group? How did you first join it?
Well, that's a strange story to Mingus Jazz Workshop and myself. You see, the job really was, well... Yeah.
How many recordings did you make with the workshop while you were there?
Well, I made about six. Now there's a new one out that was made in 1960. It's what we call a pirate record, and it's the best of all the records. I have a copy. It cost me $100. I have it in Paris. But it was something stole from French, from the French radio, sold to Japan, then imported back into France. You only can buy it in France. But it's the best of the Mingus bands, all the Mingus bands. The tape was so great that the guy who stole it cut the piano player off, who happened to be Bud Powell, but he didn't know it.
Just
knew this piano player didn't fit in that band. But it was when Bud was in his top form.
What kind of reception did you get from the audience with the workshop when you play at clubs? I get the impression from Mingus that, on the recording that I just played, the workshop recording, it's recorded in a studio, if I'm not mistaken, but Mingus says at the beginning, don't rattle those glasses and stop serving and make sure you don't applaud. Were people in clubs ready for that kind of attitude and ready for the music that was being played?
Well, the thing is, Mingus, people was never ready for what was going to happen in that band, you know, and that was his whole philosophy. You know, he would never let you just sit and relax and be ready for it. And, it's just like those things he was saying is something he used to do every night. And that was just a thing, you mm-hmm. know. You really didn't. And there was one time I remember when Eric was getting too many applause. That's when he stopped the applause. See, all those little things that you hear on the records was parts of something that really, history in that band. Each little thing is a story in itself. But he puts them all together, and it sounds like a 5-minute thing. You know,
but the things that are being recorded now is work that you played in 1964. This new Arista release, for instance.
That's right.
It's a credit to the work you were doing then, and possibly just the recording companies or you know the record buying audience in America that's you know waited till now to appreciate it.
But the thing, my best records are not even out yet. And like not in America, the best one I would think is one called Pop Wine, which you'll probably hear 10 years from now, or 12 like this one, which would surpass that. In fact, they didn't ask me, when I heard this record was coming out, I said, oh my God, why would they put that out? That's what I thought,
mm-hmm.
you know, because the record, another record, this Pop Wine record that I love so much, is superior to that. But knowing how the thing works now, it'll be 12 years before that come out.
When did you leave the States to go to Europe?
Well, I left originally in 60, but uh-huh. I was always going and coming back and not very interested in doing anything here at all, you know. Just coming back to see my family, more or less.
Okay, I want to play an excerpt of your 1964 recording on Atlantic Records. The recording's called The New Thing and The Blue Thing, and the composition we're going to hear is Ted's Tempo. And, Ted, you want to tell us something about this recording before we hear it?
Before we go into this record, that record was made first.
Oh, okay. I know it's the same year.
It was made first, and the reason why I was trying to copy this one, because this was at that time, this was the better record.
Mm-hmm.
But I never made it on this one. It just didn't come. It's good music on this one, but the spontaneity, the fire, for some reason, I think it had something to do with the actual recording. It's not that clear. You know, the actual recording of it, as you'll hear, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that record, Ted's Tempo, was I used to like to play very fast on Night in Tunisia. That's the chords, the basic chords. And I changed around to one of my own melodies. Okay. So that's why we call it Ted's Temple.
And the personnel on this group is the same people who are on the Tears for Dolphy recording?
Almost, with the exception of a French pianist called George Avenidas.
Okay. It's the same. So we'll hear Ted's Tempo from the album The New Thing and the Blue Thing, with Bill Barron on tenor sax and Herb Buschler bass, Dick Burke drums. And this, as we heard, was recorded in 1964.
Thank you.
was Ted's tempo from the album The New Thing and The Blue Thing, which is a 1964 Atlantic recording. Ted Kersen is in the studio with me now, along with James Womack from the Foxhole Collective. And as we mentioned before, Ted Kersen will be doing a memorial concert for Eric Dolphy at the Foxhole this weekend. On Friday and Saturday evening, there'll be two shows, 9 and 11. This Saturday, I think it is, marks the day that Eric Dolphy was born, about 48 years ago.
Sunday's the 20th.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we left off, Ted, talking about recording these two albums in 1964. I'd like to ask you about your reception in Europe when you first went there, and that was probably before you recorded any albums under your own name in the States.
That's true. Well, no. Well, I did make one, but it wasn't released. It was called Plenty of Horn on Old Town Records. And this is the one that had Eric Dolphy playing flute.
Mm-hmm.
Very beautiful thing. And the first time in Europe in 1960 was at the unveiling of the Sidney Bechet statue in the south of France. And when we started to play, of course, the people was very upset, and they threw paper and bottles and everything else because they thought we was making fun of them. You know, we came in with the talking and the instruments. It's the first time they ever heard anything like that. So they thought we was putting them on. So they stoned us. And it was so bad that I ended up doing Mingus had me do the interviews for him.
Oh, gee.
But what happened after that, I met some agents, and they said, if you ever come back with your own thing, you'd be welcome here. And, of course, this happened to Coltrane and a few other guys. You know, not at the same time, but at different periods.
Well, I've gotten the impression somehow that Europe is in some ways much more receptive to new jazz than the audience in the States are.
Oh, yes. Well, that's now.
Mm-hmm.
But in 60, it wasn't that way, you know. But now it has changed. See, Europe is going through a little cycle thing. During 60, they didn't understand it. Around 64, from 64 to 67, they dug it. 67 was a changeover. They don't dig it anymore. And now they're back to what we call mainstream modern. Now, in Germany, is like you can pick the countries now. You know, around in 64, I would say 64 to 66, all over Europe was very strong on black music or free jazz or modern or whatever, avant-garde, whatever you want to call it. I mean, if you was playing new music, it was you could work. You didn't have to have a name.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's only the strongest places are in Germany, and a lot of musicians still hang in Paris, but the work is in Germany. But before that, I played with Charlie Ventura for a short while at his open house in Philly. Well, it's outside of Philly. Yeah.
You spend time living in New York now, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. New York is going through all kinds of severe economic problems, but do you think that the jazz community is still flourishing there? Is New York still the place in the Northeast for jazz, do you think?
Well, I think New York now, even with the crisis, is better for jazz than ever, because if you pick up a paper like The Village Voice, there's more jazz listed there than any other time I've seen in history, since I've been in New York since 56. And so maybe depression and all those things is good for jazz, I don't know. But I know just about everybody's working, and that's great. I mean, they're not making a whole lot of bread, but they're busy and they're not recording as much. It was much more recording around 64 to 67 in New York.
Mm-hmm.
But the old records are coming out. So that's good, too, because a lot of during that period I was just mentioning, guys was recording so much, nobody heard any of the records. I mean, like, they were just coming out every week, a new album. It was impossible to keep up. Now it's slowed down to a snail pace, but at least you get a chance to hear some of the artists. Now, this is not good for the artists in one hand, because they're not making the bread. But on the other hand, people are finally getting into their music. So that's good, you know.
Would someone who's first becoming acquainted with you and through your Tears for Dolphy album, this 1964 recording, have a kind of a different sense of your playing? I mean, has your playing changed a lot since then or not?
I would say so. Unfortunately, well, if you hear the group, you'll see it's quite different. The group is a mixture of inside and outside, is one of my terms. It has some strong blues roots, but it has some strong free things. It's more of I would say it's like a synthesis of everything I've ever done. It's more of me. This is only one part of me,
mm-hmm.
A very small part.
What do you like as a leader? Now, I mean, you played with Mingus, who's one of the most probably strong-armed leaders around, very, very rigorous. What's it like to work with you?
Well, actually, I always put Mingus down for being rough, but I think I'm probably even rougher, but in another way. You know, I always believe you can get the thing you want out of a person, you know, without knocking him down. Of course, I would probably get into that, too, because I'm a pretty big guy. But, for instance, like a drummer that was playing with me in Baltimore, the biggest job I had in New York was at the bottom line. Well, I told him to do something, and he went out. I mean, he just went berserk. And if I didn't really control myself, we would have been, like, doing a little dance on the stage, you know, which would have been very uncool. And so that just brought me to mind that I could be in a Mingus thing. The thing is that when you work with, you're influenced by people without even knowing it. Just being around them, you pick up things, you know.
Okay.
And I probably picked up a lot of things from Mingus.
Who's going to be playing with you this Saturday and Friday?
Okay, we're going to have Bill Barron, tenor sax, is one of my old partners and a dynamic musician. And people will be glad to hear him. He's from Philadelphia, he's from North Philadelphia.
Kenny Barron's brother.
Yeah.
By the way.
Oh, I don't say that.
Well, likewise, because, vice versa.
You know, everybody's saying no, but everybody's saying that. But that's, I don't know. I don't think that's a nice thing to say. But anyway, Bill Barron, Joe Rigby's playing tenor and flute and alto. Jim McNeely, Fender Rhodes piano. Dennis Irvin, bass. Sam Jacobs, conga drums. I think that's it, and myself.
The concert's in memorial for Eric Dolphy, and I would suspect that many of the people who are listening to this broadcast now are not really familiar, very familiar with Dolphy's music. So I'd like to ask you to just say say a few words about his place in jazz.
Well, he was a dynamic force. You know, he's one of the true original bad cats, and he had an original sound. Usually people liked him right off, or they didn't like him at all, because his playing it wasn't the middle of the road thing. But before, now that's hard to say. When he first came on the scene, he was playing like Bird when he was playing with Chico Hamilton. This is before the Mingus thing. And one night Mingus took Eric and myself down to hear Ornette. Now this is a very important thing. This is not the point that we was copying, but he wanted us to hear them. And he asked Eric, "Can you do that?" You know, so he said, "Well, yes." But it was like another one of Mingus' great put-ons. I don't know. And so we just did that to put on the people for a while. Because, but the thing, getting back to Eric, he was one of these guys who practiced all the time, a true genius. But they promised him many things that he never received, and he died with a broken heart. In fact, when he died, I was in Paris. He was in Berlin. They called me. And he had to really leave America. And now, in some kind of way, it upsets me a little bit because all his records are out and everybody's making a big thing. But when the guy was on the set, it was like...
No recognition?
No. Well, he had to... The main point is he had to go back to Mingus Band. You see? I didn't have to go. I was I was a little bit better financially set than he was, or any of the cats. But that was kind of a drag. But, I mean... Even with all that, was great music made in that band. I guess my main point is that if we could have got out of that personal bit, you know, otherwise, if Mingus was a different kind of a person, I think we could have still made the great music. We probably could have made even more. But sometimes he sort of got in the way of us. He was pushing so hard that sometimes he probably made us stand still. I don't know. It's a crazy thing.
Okay, well, the concert again will be this coming Friday and Saturday evening at the Foxhole, and James Womack from the Foxhole Collective is in the studio. James, is there any discussion planned about Dolphy for during the concert?
Yeah, a noted black historian by the name of Harrison Ridley Jr. on Friday evening will give a kind of capsulization of Dolphy's life, his contributions to music in this country, and just a general wrap, and if the audience wants to ask questions, they may ask questions.
Okay, and that's this coming Friday and Saturday, the shows are 9 and 11 o'clock at the Foxhall, which is located on Locust Walk and 40th Street in St. Mary's Church. It's the only church-like building around, so it's really difficult to miss. There isn't really a street there. It's kind of campus proper, so where Locust Walk ends, just keep walking down what would have been a street. Ted Kirsten, I want to thank you so much for coming by to the station today, and I wish you the best of luck with your new work and with your Tears for Dolphy album, which has just been released, and at this concert this coming weekend, which I'm certainly going to try to attend.
Okay, thank you very much, and anybody come on, I think they'll be well rewarded, because the guys in the band are really happening, you know.
And it'll give us an opportunity to hear your recent work, because let me just ask you, are there recent albums available of you and your group?
No. But see, now we're getting ready to record some. We did a thing that will probably come out in September for Arista. It's planned anyway. And we're recording at Newport for Radio Free Europe. And as a guy named Alan Douglas probably will buy that tape. So right now, nothing is really out on the new group. But something should be coming out very soon.
Okay, and one more thing, that before your next tour of Europe, you will be playing again in New York at Carnegie Hall?
Yes, that's June the 27th at 1 p.m. And on that same bill is Anthony Braxton's group. He's having the sextet, and George Coleman is having the octet, and I'm having my septet. So that's a great bill, too.
Okay, Ted Kirsten, thanks again. And we'll hear from the Tears for Dolphy album. We'll hear the title recording from that album. Yeah.
Oh, there's one thing I'd like to say about that tune, Tears for Dolphy. If you ever get a chance to see a film called Terrorama, it's by Pier Pablo Pasolini, you will hear me playing this. It's called A Tune for a Dead Saxophone Player, and it's in this film. This film was released in 1966, and it's still around.
Oh, so sure. Something worth hearing. Come back to the repertory theaters.
Yeah, it's around. It's just still playing. But you'll hear me playing in the same thing, and Gato Barbieri is on that with me.
Okay. Yeah. Tears for Dolphy. Wardell Gray from an album called Central Avenue, and that was Sweet Lorraine. You're listening to Fresh Air. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. And for the next while on Fresh Air, we're going to be talking about some of the personality traits of dogs, which probably pet owners in prettying them up and teaching them how to eat home-cooked food forget about, and that's what's perhaps their inherent nature, which is as a predator. My guest in the studio is Robert Calder. That's not his real name, but that's the name he wrote the book under, and that's the name we'll be using. He has recently finished a suspense novel called The Dogs. Briefly, it's about dogs who are undergoing training at a behavioral institute, and one of them breaks away from the institute, and, well, I won't tell anymore. I'll ask Robert Calder to do it, but let me just tell you a little bit more about him. He is a novelist and also a dog authority, and as dog authority, has written a number of training manuals, including how to train attack dogs, I believe. Okay, and that's also another topic that we'll be getting into. Robert, let me ask you first to kind of give us a little capsule of the of your novel, The Dogs.
Okay, Terry, thank you. The Dogs is a book primarily about the relationship between human beings and dogs. The specifics of the story are that a dog is bred rather than trained at a behavioral institute, which is seeking to create what they think is an ideal dog. This is a dog of maximum intelligence, maximum stability, keenest scent, greatest amount of stamina, alertness, curiosity, all the things that dogs do, only to the best degree. In the process of selective breeding with any animal, of course, you go off in little byways that you have to correct for in subsequent breedings. The particular litter that the dog Orphan, who's the major dog in the book, comes from is a litter of just about average intelligence, but a heightened degree of autonomy. This is a very independent dog. The entire litter is somewhat indifferent to human beings, not aggressive or hostile toward them, but emotional relationships with human beings don't play a large role in their makeup. Through a theft and then an accident, a puppy from this litter, Orphan, is taken from the Behavioral Institute. He is found by an English professor, Alex Bauer, who is a man at this point in a state of spiritual ennui or existential despair. He has had moral difficulties in his life. He is separated from his wife and children. He's down, very down at the time. He takes the dog as a foundling, not because he particularly wants a dog, but he's told that this is deer country, this is farm country, and if he leaves the dog there, it's either going to be hit on the highway or someone's going to shoot him. He brings the dog home. He attempts to find its owner. He doesn't succeed. Over the period of a couple of intervening weeks, he does develop a fondness for the animal. The animal becomes emotionally gratifying to him, fills a void in his life. He has the dog for about a year. There is an accident in which the dog displays some aggression, bites one of his children, and then takes off for the woods in the face of his anger. At the point, the dog begins to survive in the woods, and it finds a greater freedom, a greater satisfaction than it's ever known. It eventually joins with three other dogs, feral dogs, who are living in the mountains. They form a pack. They are completely independent. They have no desire to be anywhere around human beings. They want to be left alone and just live as natural creatures. They are forced by a series of events into a couple of confrontations with human beings. They are human beings. They are attacked. They counter-strike defensively. There are three different encounters, actually, of violence with human beings. It does result in a couple of human deaths. The pack is hunted, somewhat hysterically. And there is a resolution, I suppose, which probably
we
shouldn't
give away
talk
here,
about
right.
at this point.
Well, the root of the novel, I think, gets to a kind of fear that if you let yourself feel, it becomes pretty apparent, and that's that while a dog is being very pet-like and kind of laying at your feet or licking your face or something, you sometimes feel that there's no reason to suspect that if given the opportunity, the dog would not necessarily be so inherently friendly towards people or towards you.
The dog, I don't want the book misunderstood in the sense that your house pet or your neighbor's house pet is potentially an assassin and that you've got to watch him. This is definitely not true. However, the crux of the problem is the lack of understanding on the part of human beings to the reality of the dog. The dog is it's a very vivid creature. It's an attractive creature. It's a creature that should draw respect from human beings, understanding as well as affection. Simple affection without understanding is going to be difficult for your dog. In this country today, there are 30 million dogs owned by people as pets. Each year, also, we put to death 15 million dogs in this country. We do this for one reason, that human beings are not responsible dog owners. This is an atrocity to take 15 million creatures such as the dog and summarily execute them every 12 months. This results from people doing backyard breeding, from people misunderstanding the nature of the animal that they want to bring into their home as a pet. You find people, for example, you have a female of one particular breed, I have a male, you look at the ads in the paper and you decide, well, we can make some money on puppies. So you get together, you breed your dogs, and you attempt to sell them for $75 or so. As amateurs or as people who simply don't understand the dog, you've paid no attention to your dog's conformation, to its character, to its temperament, to the level of its intelligence, to the background, its antecedents. What have their personalities been like? Now, when I breed my dogs or when I buy a puppy, I'll research back through 12 generations to see what these dogs have done in the past. Are they good obedience workers? Are they noted for any particular characteristic?
Well, as you said, the dog in the main character, the dog in your book, is bred specially, not trained specially. I mean, how much of the personality is really genetically inherited? How much can you tell by researching the personality traits of the other dogs?
You can make a very good educated guess if you know the background of the animal. My stud dog at home, I have two German Shepherds. I raise trained German Shepherds as a hobby, as a way to fill my leisure hours and because I like dogs. My stud is known, and he's a German import, is known in Germany, that particular line, for its over-aggressiveness. This does not mean he's a wild or fierce animal or the line is tough and shouldn't be around human beings. It simply indicates that you must socialize the dog as a puppy, that you have to pay attention to its obedience training and make sure that it's a civilized animal. Now, that dog that I'm referring to is, in fact, fully attack-trained. He'll attack into gunfire, he'll attack against a club. He's a tough dog on the attack. However, I could also take him into a room full of kindergarten children and leave him there for the entire afternoon and let them poke pencils in his eye. I wouldn't permit anyone to poke pencils in his eyes, but should they do this, as children frequently do, or pull his tail or attempt to ride him, I'd have no worry about him ever showing his teeth. He attacks only on command, or if a member of my family is knocked down.
How? Now, you trained him to do that?
No, he was an imported dog. He was a Schutzhund too, which is a German training degree. He was trained when I got him. I've done subsequent training with him. The bitch I have at home, I have done the training myself. I've trained several other dogs. I advise police departments occasionally and work with service dogs.
Okay, now, just getting back to the idea of genetically inherited traits, if this dog, which came from a line of highly aggressive dogs, was kind of trained by someone to be docile, attentive, obedient, and calm. I mean, could the
dog...
You
don't train a dog to be docile.
Another
index of a dog,
I mean,
when you evaluate an animal, is its level of activity.
Mm-hmm.
Its sensitivity to human beings, both by voice and touch. If you say no or you shout no harshly for a dog who's doing something particularly outrageous, some dogs don't care. You can bellow at them through a bullhorn, and they're just not very sensitive to the human voice. Others, if you so much as whisper, no. You know, the dog snaps its head around and immediately stops what it's doing. There's sensitivity to touch. Some dogs couldn't care less if they're on a leash or if they're given a correction. A dog like the Staffordshire Terrier. Physically, he's hard to impress. You know, almost, as one trainer says, first you hit him with a 2x4 over the head, and once you've got his attention, then you can start to train him. A dog like a Sheltie, that is what most people think is the miniature collie, is a very soft and sensitive dog. It's a terrific working dog, but in the training you have to go very lightly with him. You have to talk to him frequently, praise him a lot, and help build his ego. The leash correction in training that you would give to a German Shepherd would just freak a Sheltie, and he'd be upset for the remainder of the day, and you couldn't work with him anymore.
Well, I once in my life came upon an attack dog, and I was told by the people who owned this farm that he was trained to kill at the word kill. And I thought that it might be, but I was nevertheless very, very uneasy in the dog's presence. Now, I mean,
well, I would be uneasy about the owners. I mean, anyone who tried to impress me by telling me that they have a dog that'll kill, I worry about the personality of that owner.
But is that done? I mean, there are attack dogs who
are
trained to kill.
There are a couple varieties of attack dogs. There is no such thing as a dog who is trained to kill. If for no other reason than that, it would be extremely difficult to do the training. You'd have to train, for example, to go for the throat. And in attack training, you require an agitator. That's the bad guy. That's the criminal, the guy that's baiting the dog and who's being hit by the dog. And even if you put an iron collar around my throat, there is no way I'm going to let the jaws of a dog, a biting dog, anywhere near my face or my throat. And with an iron collar, of course, the dog's going to break his teeth off on it, and he's going to refuse to bite anything like that again. An attack dog generally is trained to go, many people say, for the weapon arm. That usually simply means the right arm, since most people are right-handed. The training to go for the weapon arm only is rather difficult. In the heat of the combat, the dog will probably take the nearest piece of flesh. If you're kicking at the dog, he's going to take your foot. If you're running away from the dog, he'll probably bite you on the buttock or the leg. If you're attempting to club him or you're extending a gun or a knife toward him, sure, he'll take you on the arm then.
How do you train a dog to do that?
Well, one point I would like to make about attack dogs before we get into any of the form of the training is this, that there is a terrific misconception about attack dogs. People will tell you, my cousin has got a great attack dog, man. They have to chain him to the bathroom door before they can have guests in because he wants to wipe everybody out. This is a very poor dog. An attack dog that is intended to live around human beings. Now, I have two children myself. They have friends over frequently. They wrestle in the fields. They run. They shout. They punch each other. Were my dogs hyper about this, looking for a point to be aggressive at any time, I'd have difficulties. Now, The well-trained attack dog living with a human being, this applies to most police dogs also, who have to be walked through crowds, taken into buildings, into restaurants, in subways occasionally. Now, if you have a dog who's going for everybody all the time, I mean, it's counterproductive. Now, my dogs, for example, will attack on a one-word command. They will also release the bite on a one-word command. After having undergone a combat where they have been on a sleeve, say, for 3 minutes with someone shouting at them, clubbing them, and that is clubbing them with a styrofoam club. This is nothing that hurts them. It's simply to accustom the dog to the fact that something may come down fast mm-hmm. from overhead to strike him. So if it happens in a real situation, he's not alarmed by it and doesn't go back. But after a pretty tough combat with a single word command, the well-trained attack dog will release the bite and step back. He will not re-attack until he is told to re-attack or unless he is assaulted. Under all other circumstances, the dog should behave just like any well-mannered pet that you might see around. The dog remains affectionate. He climbs on the kids' beds. He should lick people's faces. He should enjoy his toys. He should enjoy romps in the country with you. He's just a fine, affectionate pet. The dog does not attack because it dislikes human beings. It attacks because it's been trained. Excuse me. Think, for example, of a boxer. You can't tell a professional boxer by the fact that he walks down the street punching people in the face. You know? He's a civilized human being in all other respects. He gets into the ring, the bell rings, and he fights. The attack dog should do the same thing. He's a very civilized, affectionate, loyal animal under all other circumstances until he's given a command. Then he simply performs an obedience routine. Now, I grant he develops loyalty to the owner. He puts a little heart into it, and in the training, you attempt to impress the dog with the fact that not only he, but his master is being menaced or threatened a little bit too. So a large part of the dog's motivation comes from the fact that he desires to protect his family, which is his surrogate pack.
Now, if, say, I owned a dog who I wanted to get attack trained, would I be there for the training so that he learned to associate danger I was in with a reason for him to attack?
Ideally, you would be. I will do it, but I don't like to attack train a dog unless the master holds the other end of the leash. A dog who is trained, as some of the service dogs are, particularly in the Air Force, for multiple handlers, is never quite as sharp, never has the same heart as the dog who works simply for you, who knows you from puppyhood, and who is not handled by three strangers that he has no reason to work for, that he doesn't relate to well.
Is the structuring process, the structuring of the dog's behavior through reward and punishment, or strictly reward, strictly punishment?
Not in the sense that those are usually employed. Food training, for example, is what most people mean when they say reward, and food training is an inferior way to train any dog, even for strict obedience.
Because when you stop giving the food, the behavior stops?
The dog tends to think more about his stomach than uh-huh. the job at hand. He's looking for the session to end so he gets his treat and reward. If you give him commands in situations where you don't happen to have a pocket full of goodies after half a dozen times of not receiving his treat, he's simply not, you're not reliable. You've demonstrated, you know, if you worked and didn't get your paycheck every sixth Friday or so, you'd begin to lose a bit of loyalty toward the people you work for. And this happens with the dog, too. A dog's motivation in training, and this is all phases of training, is essentially that he wishes to please his master. Now, this is not to suggest that the dog, as many people think he is a slobberingly affectionate creature whose total life revolves about being told he's a good dog and having his belly scratched. He requires and he needs affection, and if he doesn't get it, he's going to develop psychological problems. But he is also an animal with his own dignity, with his own sense of worth and rights, with very powerful emotional needs. Capable of psychological sophistication. He's capable of abstraction and conceptualization on a rudimentary level. Training is not simply a matter of rote that you walk him through a routine 500 times until it becomes a habit. In the best training, you want the dog to concentrate on the job at hand, to think about it, to be very focused on what he's doing. It should have his total intelligence.
Still, though, I mean, you can't talk to the dog and say, this is the task I want you to do, now concentrate. You have to kind of shape the dog's behavior through something. What is
sure.
that something?
You do talk to the dog, not so much in sitting down and say, come, let us reason together. However, you talk to the dog by the tone of your voice, you talk to the dog in the fashion in which you touch it. You talk to the dog in the way you treat it in non-training areas. You're constantly talking to your dog, whether you know it or not. The dog knows it. And if you're not speaking the language, your result... No, sure. Now coercion for a moment. In obedience training, for example, it is not natural to the dog to walk in the rigid requirements of the heel position. He'd much rather range out in front of you 10, 12 feet, dance around, chase something, and look at things. So some element of compulsion is necessary. You put him on a 6-foot training leash. You spend 2 or 3 days on any given routine making sure the dog understands the nature of the activity. If you're teaching the sit, for example, you stop the dog at your side. You put very gentle upward pressure on the chain while holding his hips and pressing down at the same time. You put him into the seated position with a single command, sit. And then you praise him a lot as soon as he's down there. This usually takes 3 or 4 days for him to understand the nature of the action. Once he's demonstrated that he knows the task at hand, then you are justified in correcting him if he refuses to perform the task. Now, by correction, you don't mean yelling at the dog, calling him a dumb son of a gun, hitting him, or any other form of negative behavior. Think of a correction in this term. If I'm walking with my dog at heel, and he decides to go streaking ahead of me, break his position to chase a squirrel or bark at somebody on the road, I will make an immediate about-face and take off running. Now,
towards him or away from him?
Away from him. Now, there's only 6 feet to the training leash. Occasionally work with a 20-foot leash. That's for different things. When he hits the end of the 6 feet, I mean, it's going to be a jolt. What I'm attempting to do is flip him over on his back. Believe me, you're not going to hurt a dog like a shepherd. Don't do this with a Sheltie, of course. Being smaller dogs, you can't hurt them. You have to modify the strength of this. Generally speaking, you'll only have to do this 2 or 3 times to convince the dog that he's got to hold the heel position. Now, I have not yelled at the dog. I haven't called him a dumb dog. I haven't expressed any displeasure. I have simply exercised my right to pick the direction we're going to go. If he hasn't been paying attention, sure, he's going to get a jolt at the end of leash. That's the sort of thing I mean when I'm talking about a correction.
Do you ever feel that... Well, dogs are domesticated animals now. I mean, nobody really thinks twice about disciplining dogs. But do you ever think twice about it? Do you ever think that the complete infliction of your will on an animal is?
I don't inflict my will completely on the animal. I make a great deal of compromises. I am willing to do things that the dog desires us to do. And in training, also, you are playing off natural impulses of the dog. The dog, I can't stress this enough, the dog is a bright creature. It needs outlets for its intelligence. It needs outlets for its enthusiasms. Now, when you say the dog is domesticated, of course that's true. Now, the dog has been domesticated. Some authorities will try and tell you it's been 15,000 years. Probably it's been about 10,000 years that the first dogs moved into the lean-tos, the stick huts, the small hide tents. Certainly no one put collars on them at that point. If a man had presumed to put a collar on a dog, you know, the dog would have assassinated him and taken off for the woods. He was still a wild creature at that point. Now, by domestication, think in these terms. The dog has not been a pet, in Western society anyway, until about the 19th century, the early 19th century. Prior to that, the dog was a tool. As much as a fast horse was a tool, a keen-aged weapon, any sort of hammer. The dog functioned for man. There would have been no relationship between men and dogs had not the dog been able to work for man. Now, in the beginning, the dogs were used primarily in hunting. Probably there was association, loose association between men and dogs where there wasn't any real hardcore relationship, but dogs either followed hunting groups of men, cleaned up after the kill because, you know, there were easy animals. There were wounded animals to bring down, and maybe there was some offal left, piles of intestines, bones with meat on them. And, you know, the dog, like a human being, will take the easy way out if he can accomplish what he accomplishes, what he wishes to accomplish with less effort. That's what he's going to do. There was profit for the men in this. They could pursue dogs who were running animals. By keeping the sounds of baying in ear, getting a high vantage point to be able to watch a plane a mile away after the dogs were finished with a kill, they could go in and clean up wounded animals. Or, even better, they could drive a pack of dogs off a kill. And, you know, they have their meat with very little problem either. Now, after this, there was a quick translation. Man, in his inevitable and relentless, brutal pragmatism, turn the dog to war very quickly. The dog was well suited to this, given its predatory nature, given its pack loyalty. And recall also at this time, dogs basically were much more aggressive and closer to a wilder state than they are now. You will find in Egyptian hieroglyphics, you'll find depictions of war dogs being used. Cambyses of Persia had a squadron of 400 dogs that were in the vanguard of battle. They fought with the Greeks on the plain of Marathon. Henry VIII used them. The conquistadors used them. Dogs were terrific in warfare until about the invention of gunpowder. This pretty much removed them from the battlefield proper. However, World War I, 70,000 dogs served. They served as sentries, guards, trackers, depot protectors, and ambulance dogs. There were dogs that, after massive battles, would go out into the field, find wounded men who were not dead, go back to the ambulance corps.
Well, so in that sense, there's still dogs on the police force.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But the major point of this is that the relationship between man and dogs was essentially a business relationship. And it wasn't until the latter part of the Industrial Revolution, the great rise of the industrial towns, when you had a lot of people coming in from urban environments that missed the mountains, that missed the green, that were frightened by cities. Cities like Manchester, England, you know, the great industrial hellholes. And by bringing in a dog, you brought a bit of the country with you. You brought another life form. You brought some solace into these cities with you. And recall also that life was very harsh for most people, particularly prior to the early 19th century. And you couldn't afford pets. There's a quote from a Roman writer from the 4th century who speaks very derisively of those greedy pet dogs at table who don't do anything to justify their existence. The Romans were cute people with dogs also. They fought them in the Colosseum against bears and lions. At that time, the only people who could afford such a luxury as a pet were the aristocracy. And in the 17th, 16th centuries even, the wealthier aristocracy did have small pet dogs. One king of France, I forget the name offhand, but was ridiculed because he used to take a little toy dog into church with him, suspended from his neck in a golden cage. The aristocracy,
it's kind of odd way to go anywhere.
But the aristocracy and using pets in medieval Europe, the later Middle Ages and then into the Renaissance, were frequently quite silly about what they did with pets. But for the most of Western culture, dogs have only been pets for about 150 years. And in the main, I think the dogs probably still aren't aware of their status as pets. And if they were, most of them would be insulted about it. They think it's still a two-way partnership. It's emotionally gratifying for both parties, but it's basically a working relationship.
Now, there is a kind of working relationship between people and dogs that I'd like to talk about, and that's dog fights. And I'm not saying that's a healthy working relationship, but it does exist, and you're one of the people who knows about its existence. I guess dog fights are similar to cock fights, where the two dogs are put together in an enclosed area and fight to the death. Why is this done? Is it for gambling purposes? Do people make large bets?
It's done for gambling and sport. Using the word sport in its original sense, not in the ethical sense that we'd use on it today. There's a long history of this. I mean, going back, as I referred to a moment ago, to the Roman Colosseum, I mean, man has always considered man fighting each other, man fighting animals, and animals fighting each other as sport. Bullfighting still exists. Mexico, Spain, Portugal has a more humane form of bullfighting where the bull isn't killed. About 600 years worth of dog fighting, which comes down from barren bull baiting in England, has resulted in the present-day dog fights in the United States. Now, curiously, the people who fight dogs, who breed them, train them, bring them to the pits, and I'd like to point out that about 50% of all dog fights end in the death of one dog, don't dislike dogs, don't look upon them as sheer meat to make money on. Paradoxically, I have seen these dog fighters kiss the wounds of their dogs, occasionally cry over a dead dog. But this is atypical. Most don't go to that extreme.
Well,
but most generally are fond of their animals, even though they're putting them into the pit either to kill or be killed. They're generally fond of the animals. And in one sense, they perhaps have a closer idea of the dog as a natural creature, although I think their concept is basically perverted too, in that respect of saying that the dogs that they fight want to fight. They're right. These dogs are American pit bulls. They are Staffordshire Terriers, occasionally crosses with bull mastiffs. The two best fighting dogs, and that's using best in the terms of the most efficient in the ring, are the pit bulls and the Staffordshire Terrier. Both of these are dogs that tighten into a total musculature and being a fighting frenzy at the sight of another dog. They have hundreds of years' worth of instincts behind them, selectively bred instincts, to do nothing but fight. That's all they want to do. Now, generally, too, a dog like the Staffordshire Terrier makes a very good house pet. He's terrific with children. He'll watch your baby. He'll jump on your kid's bed, lick their faces, lick all your friends, never bite a guest at your house. But show him another dog, or show him even small game, squirrels, kittens, things like this, and he wants to kill. This is not can you call a dog evil for wanting to fight? You know, it's the nature of the beast. Can you call a tiger evil when it hits an antelope?
Well, what about the people who continue this practice, though? What do you
people
call
continue
them?
The practice? Yeah, well, there are a variety of things to call them. Not many of which are repeatable on radio. There are about 200 or 300 individuals in the United States who are almost on a full-time level breeding, training, and pitting dogs on a regular basis.
Where does this happen? I mean, it's not legal, right?
It's illegal. No, it's highly illegal. Massachusetts is a big state for it.
But where within the state? You'd have to find someplace unknown by the police.
It's damn difficult to get into a fight unless you've got a contact someplace, someone who can vouch for you. See, in 1974, there was some exposés on dog fighting, and the people who were fighting the dogs got very tight about it. As a consequence, there are a couple of journals, for example, published. One with the incredible name of Your Friend and Mine, which is a fighting journal offering trained dogs for sale, giving descriptions of recent fights. And some of these descriptions run like, you know, an hour and 15 minutes into the fight, baby is chewing apart Henry's chest.
I made the mistake of reading one of those descriptions during lunch.
They're brutal.
They're very brutal, yeah.
As fighting dogs, now, most people think of a dog fight as lots of snarls, quick action in 5 minutes. The true fighting dogs are dogs that can take an enormous amount of punishment. There are dogs that have limped across the ring with both front legs broken to re-attack. They keep going. They ignore physical pain. They don't care if they're blinded. Well, occasionally a dog does take enough punishment that it does something that's called, in the business, it's called a turn or curring. That means you'll lose the fight. They'll give the dog a chance to come back again, but if he doesn't, then the fight's over. An owner can call off a fight at any given moment. He can say, well, my dog's about to be killed, or it's going to lose. It's taking this punishment. Frequently, they won't call off a fight. They'll say, well, the damn dog's been chewed up enough now, or he's got no heart, or I'm disappointed in him, so let him be finished off. 50% of the fights go to the death, and a fight will take anywhere from 15 minutes to 2.5 hours.
What kind of bets run on this? A lot of money?
Oh, from small scrap fights or something called rolls, which is a very young dog that's in training and you're not really putting him into a pit for heavy fighting yet. You might have $5 and $10 fights, or if you get a couple of crude guys who go down to the SPCA and adopt, in quotes, two dogs that they think are going to be tough or mean, and they put them together in a garage and bet $5 or $10 on them. The highest recorded bet, and I can't vouch for the authenticity of this. I mean, it's hard to get documentation, but I've heard it from several sources, was $20,000. It is not infrequent for the average bets to be a couple of $100 for an owner to put $5,000 or $6,000 on his dog. Now, organized crime is moving into dogfighting in the last year or two. 2 years ago, two dogfighters were found in Texas with their hands tied behind their back, shot through the head. This seemed to be a gangland execution. There's also heavy prostitution now going on at some of the dog fights, and narcotics. Now, another sort of irony is in one of the dog fighting magazines recently, there was a protest that said this used to be a good, clean, gentleman's sport until the bad elements moved in, and it said the bad elements are giving dog fighting a bad name. And, you know, this is ridiculous. But that is the mentality of the dog fighter.
So, well, I've seen a lot of neighborhood dogs when encountering each other getting into a fight, but they, do you think if the owners didn't come in and throw cold water on their heads or pull at the leashes or jump between them, do you think that they would end up fighting till one was severely disabled?
No. In 98% of all fights between dogs, Either one dog will have enough after a bite or two, and he will offer submission to what he considers the victor, the stronger dog in the fight, and then the fight's over. All you have to do in any situation with dogs, look, in a natural state, among wolves, jackals, coyotes, and dogs gone wild, feral dogs, you have a hierarchy, and you have an alpha dog. And this can be either a male or a female. Generally, it is a male simply because the male is stronger, heavier, and usually more aggressive. But frequently enough, it is a female. If she's the strongest or most intelligent in the pack, she'll lead and the others will follow. The hierarchy is usually settled by some form of combat. If not physical combat, at least there will be a challenge. A young dog in the pack or a young wolf is feeling his oats. He's 2 years old. Now he feels strong and he locks eyes with the alpha dog. Now, this is how a dog fight starts. There is direct gaze into each other's eyes. Once they're looking into each other's eyes, one of two things can happen. Either one dog offers submission, generally by turning